och välkomna till Stressforskningspodden som idag kommer att handla om konflikter. Och den här intervjun kommer att vara på engelska, så att vi går över till engelska nu. So, dear listeners, again, welcome to the Stress Research Podcast. And today we have the pleasure of having Sabina Chahadjic-Clancy as a guest in the podcast. So, hi and welcome.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me.
And Mats is here, as usual.
Hi there. Hi, Mats. Welcome, Sabina.
Thank you, Mats. Thank you, Sandra.
And it's really an interesting topic that we're diving into. But first of all, would you like to start by introducing yourself to the listeners, Sabina?
Yes, I would. Where do I start? So, I will try to introduce myself from the lens of my work and my research. So I was born and raised in Sarajevo, in Bosnia. And why that is relevant is because when I was 12, the conflict erupted in the former Yugoslavia at that time, and has made me become a refugee for many, many years to follow. And I assume that, not assume, I know, that experience of having lived through war and then having lived as a refugee, and I ended up in Germany after changing several countries, has really shaped not only who I am today and my worldviews, but also has influenced gravely my work and research questions that I'm trying to understand in my work, in my research. So that is very much in brief my personal background. But in terms of, I'm a social psychologist. So I am trying to, as a social psychologist, having received training in the UK and in the US, really trying to understand how to improve intergroup relations or relations between groups who have been or who are in conflict. And by conflict, we mean a grave scale and large scale conflict, such as the war in former Yugoslavia, such as the war in Bosnia that I've experienced, such as the war and the violence that is happening right now as we speak in Ukraine or in the Middle East. So these are the kind of the large scale conflicts that my research is embedded within and that I'm trying to understand using social psychological theories and using social psychological methods to understand how we can improve those broken relations that have been broken for legitimate and good reasons. But we now need to find ways to repair trust and repair relations and bring people closer to each other.
You really have a personal history and investments in the area of studies. Would you mind telling us a little bit of this?
Yes, I do. I mean, yes, my research is personal. I don't know if this is the good thing to say, you know, publicly and out loud, that I don't know. But yes, it is. I mean, it is personal. It is personal. And in many, many ways. And for example, my doctoral dissertation, my doctoral research was very much about trying to understand how people deal with their group's atrocities and moral wrong that has been committed by members of their group, and very often in the name of the group that they come from. So in this, you know, I've been very much, or in other words, trying to understand how can we bring people to acknowledge what is happening, what has been done, what their group has committed against others, very often innocent people. And, you know, dealing with these moral wrongs and has been very close to my heart and very close to home, because I come from a context where wrong has been done against my group.
Right.
So if we put it, I don't like to victimize myself or to label and use those terminology as victim groups, but if we were to use it, I come from a group that could be labeled as the victim group, right? So it's very personal and very, very personal, wanting and expecting justice, wanting and expecting reparations, wanting and expecting admission of responsibility. And sometimes that can be followed by guilt as well. And then, so that is obviously the personal angle. And then I ended up not knowing where I will end up. You know, that's what war is. War is very unpredictable. And human lives, my life became very unpredictable. I ended up in Germany, you know, for 4 years, going to German schools, living in that culture, growing up in that culture. And then...
You were a refugee.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, right.
Correct. I was a refugee. I was... I lived there between 13 and 17, so critical years in a way. You know, my developmental critical years, I grew up in Germany as a refugee.
With your family?
Only with my mother and my younger brother. My father stayed in Sarajevo during the war, so we were separated. We separated thinking that we will come together very quickly. We didn't expect this war to go on for so long. We really thought the international community will do something and stop it. So this is why we decided for my father to stay behind, or for my grandparents to stay behind, or for everybody to stay behind. And then we ended up being separated for 4 years. Had we known that we will be separated for so long, we probably wouldn't have, we would have stayed together. That's what I'm trying to say. So it's very unpredictable, you know, every day was unpredictable. We really didn't know what next day is going to bring. So ended up in Germany. And now in retrospect, that experience has also shaped me a lot, you know, and learning from the German context and how they as a nation have dealt with their guilt and with their nation's moral wrong has really shaped me in a good way in this particular case. So it's all very personal to answer your question. Yes.
It is.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and apart from being personal, you mentioned this to us before the interview that you came to think of a special book or a special that has actually become a movie.
Yes.
Which also relates to your German history, basically.
Yes, yes.
Would you like to say something about that?
Yes. I mean, this happened after my German experience. So war is over. I come back to Bosnia. Peace accord has been signed. I come back. I study psychology, choose psychology as my undergraduate, and then leave. But it was a very different reason for leaving. Then I left for the United Kingdom. But it was a leaving by choice, not leaving by force. And then I ended up, I was very fortunate to work with really one of the most eminent social psychologists in the world, Professor Brown, Rupert Brown. And he then, during my being my supervisor, he then gave me a birthday present. And it was this book by a famous German author, Bernhard Schlink, called The Reader. And the book is very much about, set in the context of dealing with the Holocaust and everything that the German nation at that time has committed through a story. So it's through one lens and one story. But basically the book is about guilt and dealing with guilt and shame that can come up in individuals, in people, even if they themselves haven't done any wrong. And it was very, very moving reading that book. And it was very relevant because my research was about group-based guilt.
Already at your PhD studies time.
My PhD was actually about that.
Right.
My PhD was really much about group-based guilt and group-based shame and as group-based emotions and what those are, When do we feel them? When we feel them, what kind of behaviors do they drive or not? Who are the individuals who feel those emotions? So this was basically what my research was about. And it was very much depicted in the book from a different, obviously, angle, right? But still the same questions trying to be unpacked, you know, me with my research approach, you know. But so that's one of the pieces of literature that has been relevant and informative, I guess, in my journey, personal and professional journey.
Can you tell us about the guilt, how you met that, how you dealt with guilt in Germany?
Look, this is, so we just have to contextualize this. I come as a non-German, having no affiliations with Germany whatsoever, right. You know, family ties or any other ties, right? Never been in Germany in my life before. No, I don't even think I knew any Germans, you know, at that time. So I end up in this country, in this culture, in this context, going to German gymnasium. I think I was a seventh grade, I think, at that time. So, and then as a part of a curriculum, formal education, we learned about Second World War. We learned the way we were taught in Germany about Second World War and what the German nation has done has induced guilt in me and me not having any association or affiliation with Germans. So imagine how these kinds of formal education must have left traces in people who are German or who identify as German. I don't identify as German. So,
and how you can adopt like a group-based feeling like guilt in this, even though you were not German,
yes,
you would adopt it.
Yes. If I now think about it, what I adopted was more a sense of responsibility. Uh-huh. Maybe not so much. My best friend, who still is German, she was plagued by guilt. She still is. Maybe I wasn't because I'm not, I don't, you need to have identification. Mm-hmm. It's for this as the basis for this group-based emotion to arise in the first place. And I don't have that social identification or social identity. But what it did to me is really induced a sense of responsibility in the sense of answering a question to me, providing answers. How should we all of us deal with the knowledge that wrong has been committed or that wrong is being committed as we speak now in different contexts. So it really taught me the sense of responsibility. And I really appreciate that experience, you know, my German experience and cultural experience, actually, right? Very, very much, because it's really showed me that it's possible to systematically unpack such a difficult past for the better, for the good of the world, right?
Yeah. Sandra, can I ask you, do you know about guilt in Russia? Because your mother is from Russia and you speak Russian and you have studied there.
Well, I mean, I think Russia is very different in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And I mean, guilt is probably not the most pronounced, feeling there in general, because the idea has always been that Russia is superior to everyone else in a way, and that there's this very, I mean, it's a very special country because there's never actually been any democracy for many hundreds of years. So the expectation is kind of that the state per se is, you can't trust anyone. I think it's a very, with some specific, some specific time points, there might be guilt as well. But I don't think it's the same type, because it's rather, I don't think they're over it in the same way. I mean, I think it's very, very different compared to Germany.
Yeah, it's... And it's different in Sweden as well, obviously, and we have been very slow in taking blame and guilt for what happened during the Second World War. And I can just mention that we, because it came up earlier in this podcast when we talked about prejudices, that we played a music play in Germany about Swedish Romani travelers and what happened here in terms of prejudice and maltreatment, etc. And that the Germans just, when we played it in Berlin, they just loved it to hear about Swedish racial biology and being the first in the world with an institute actually specifically dealing with this issue, first in the world, and they just loved that, us taking blame and showing guilt.
Yeah. I mean, and just so we are clear here, in the it's more common not to feel guilt, not to accept responsibility. And I'm talking about individual level, but here I'm talking primarily about collective nation level. So it's much more common, unfortunately, to adopt this defensive historical approach to one's past, like, for example, Russia is doing now. You know, these famous moral disengagement theory and strategies coined by Bandura, right, are very much present at the collective level. So we will, people and nations will do everything before coming to terms and acknowledging and then maybe feeling guilty or shame, right? So denying, justifying, minimizing the harm, distancing oneself from what has happened. All of this is much more common. And this is what we've shown in our work. This is exactly what we have shown empirically in our research. And this is why we wanted to see, okay, this is the reality in the ground, but is there anything now that we can do using our research to change this reality?
Tell us more about your research.
Yes. So as I said, for a long time, we tried to understand these processes and how people deal with atrocities committed by their group, what emotions do they feel, et cetera, et cetera. How can we repair relations? But now our primary focus is on interventions. And what we mean by interventions is we are aiming at developing evidence-based and effective interventions that will be effective for changing not intergroup relations between in conflict contexts. So our work is very much about this right now, interventions. Yeah.
And can you say something about whether that's on the individual or group level, or like where do we start?
Yeah, we work with individuals, but we work with individuals in contexts of conflict, but we work with individuals from the basis that they are members of social groups, and we are examining their emotions and their attitudes and their behaviors towards other individuals, but towards other individuals as members of other social groups. So this social group or social categorizations, a social identity is the lens that we are, or the context, right, that we are working within, but it's a very individual-based level, I guess, to answer your question.
Could you walk us through such an intervention? Just like give a practical example. How would it look like?
Yeah, I mean, there are many. So there really are now. By now, they are. I'm very happy and proud to say that social psychology has advanced to such grave extent that we have now really a plethora of fantastic.
Because that's a change in social psychology,
isn't
it?
It's a huge change. It's a huge, huge change. And there's so many fantastic scholars and researchers right now working on this. And for your listeners right now, just in a fantastic handbook just was published called Psychological Intergroup Interventions, edited by one of the most famous social psychologists, Eran Halperin, who is based in Israel at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and one of my closest collaborators as well and colleague. And to give you an example, right? I mean, there are many. I am going to mention one. And the reason I'm going to mention this particular one is because we have developed this one. And it's a really dear intervention of mine and that we by now have tested in, I believe, 6 or 7 conflict contexts, including Sweden as well, which is not necessarily regarded as a conflict context, but it is definitely a diverse, culturally diverse context with potential for conflict. So we regard it as a pre-conflict society, and we are testing our interventions in Sweden as well. And the intervention that I specifically would like to mention is the so-called moral exemplar intervention, which consists of stories. Of stories of individuals, sometimes they can be out-group individuals, sometimes they can be your own in-group individuals, who have risked their life to save the life of an out-group member in the context of conflict. And why is this important? In the context where the norm is not to help the other. The norm and the expectation is to harm the other. So these are the individuals who are taking risks, helping others, and going against the norm at that particular moment or at that particular time. So these are the stories that we collect of these individuals.
True stories.
Yes. We have tested whether true or fictional stories are more effective, and we have found that realistic stories, we adapt them, of course, for the purpose of experiments and research, but we find our inspiration in true stories. And then we take those and then we adapt it to fit the intervention expectation and the format and the design, etc. And then we go into schools, into high schools, into universities, into villages, depending where we work, and we tell people these stories. And then we don't tell people these stories, so depending on what experimental group they are assigned to. And then we measure their responses, not to the stories, but we measure their responses, their attitudes towards social groups or enemy groups, right? These are adversary groups. And we are observing positive change. Because people are truly inspired when they learn that they have helped us. Because the expectation is they are bad people. This is really the default belief in conflict contexts, that we are the good guys, they are the bad guys. They're all the same, by the way. So this is what people believe. So we are basically challenging these pre-existing beliefs that they're all bad with these stories. And this is just an example.
Yeah, right.
And we are finding that it is effective in changing how people think and feel about social outgroups or relevant social outgroups in that particular context.
And what happens then with the control group and the experimental group? Exposed to these interventions?
Yes. So we have also stories in the control group, but these are not moral exemplar stories. So these are just positive or neutral stories about the same individual. So it's a very rigorous control group. So participants in our control group read stories about the same people who are just depicted in a positive way. But that doesn't do anything. So just telling people they are nice people will not change your beliefs or your behaviors towards your enemy group.
That is not a big enough challenge.
It's not big enough. So positive information is not... I mean, this is classic work in stereotypes and prejudice reduction, you know, going back to how do we reduce prejudice. Mm-hmm. And just exposing people to positive information about others is not enough for people. And there are many reasons why it's not enough for people to change their prejudice or their stereotypes, right? But these stories seem to be effective. And we believe and we argue that one reason they are effective is because it's more than just positive information about others. There is definitely an element of risk-taking that these individuals have undergone that induces, in a way, a sense of awe and admiration and inspiration in people when they read these stories. So it's a very moving, moving information.
Is that a central part that they actually get this emotional experience because they risked, the exemplars risked something?
I believe it's definitely essential because we contrasted, as I said, our control group. Nothing happens in our control group. Right? We don't observe any statistical change.
But I mean, it could be without risk. But do you think the risk is an important element? It could be just giving money.
I believe so. I believe so. Because what people in conflict and what people really want from enemies or those that are perceived as enemies, they expect some risks on their behalf, right? They want to see deeds, not just words. I even believe in Bernhard Schlink. So going back to Bernhard Schlink, there is a famous quote
I
can now recall the specific quote, but there is a reference to this as a victim. What I'm expecting from you, what I care about is what you do, not what you say. Right? And this is what it's very important for the victims or for the other side of the story of the conflict. You know, I need to see that your, let's say, guilt or responsibility is followed by behavior, because what you do is the indicator to me that I might trust you again. What you say, because the trust is broken. We have to put this in the context.
Right.
If we have no trust, if I tell you something, how will you it's not going to translate into trust building, right? But the behaviors and the, you know, will have more power to repair this broken trust. Yes.
You mentioned that you go to schools and do this kind of intervention. Is it, I mean, do you have like a specific time window in your development where you're more, where it's more likely to make these changes, you think? Or is it?
I see.
Mean, would it be easier to do interventions in younger people and then kind of expect a change? Or can you repair something with grown-ups as well?
Yeah, to be honest, most of our research focuses on youth, meaning generation, you know, between 18 and 25. And most evidence from general intergroup interventions is youth focused. And this is where we observe change. We have some data as well from older or more representative samples, and we are also observing change. But we have not yet compared the effect size, right, between younger or older generations. But it's a good question. But yeah, it's a good question.
So how can you measure the changes? I mean, can you tell us more about outcomes? How long will it last? Would behavior be changed as well as attitudes?
Yes. So most of outcome measures in the field of intergroup interventions have been self-reported attitudinal measures, most. Yeah. However, this has improved lately in the past few years significantly, that research now includes real-life behaviors. And it is indicating that we are observing the same effects on real-life behaviors as well, which is fantastic. So we are seeing a translation from attitudinal measure to behavior measures. So that is a very good progress and progression of this research. However, there is really little research that has adopted this longitudinal design where we would follow these changes or whether these changes persist over time. And there is some evidence on that some of these interventions, because I said there's many of these interventions, are effective even 3 months later or 6 months later. But this is definitely an area where we need more work, right? We need to really understand which of these interventions that we have now developed and that seem to be effective, both for attitudes, behavior, which of these interventions are actually durable, right, over time. And this is where this research is happening as we are speaking. And my research is going to go, my current research and my future research will go exactly investigating this particular question.
Cool.
Yeah.
And you are working with the United Nations and as well as the Swedish government, I think.
Yes.
Is it implementation or is it research or both?
It's implementation primarily.
Wonderful.
So,
congrats.
Thank you. They are right now. I was very fortunate to, because I recently moved to Sweden, but very, very fortunate to have been recognized by the Swedish Agency for Peace and Development, Folke Bernadotte Academy, that has received recently a mandate from the Swedish government to work on reconciliation in the Western Balkan context. And they hired me as their advisor on which community-based approaches and projects and programs and initiatives, but also policy level as well, should they support and for what reason, right? So that they would then bring about reconciliation and sustainable peace in the context of the Balkans. So it's very much implementation-based, but using evidence that comes from research, right? So what I'm trying to do is I'm kind of, my role is to translate evidence that we have into policy recommendations or suggestions. I mean, that's all I can do. I can do all the work, but I can basically point them in the right direction. So yes, I work for Folke Bernadotte Academy. I also have worked for United Nations for many, many years, primarily, again, in the context of the Western Balkans, primarily with UNDP, United Nations Development Program, who is also focusing on peace building initiatives and peace building projects in conflict contexts. So yes.
And is there evidence from other countries or similar situations where it actually worked to do these kind of interventions and then see effects on a large scale? So actually having, you know, effects on the conflict itself,
yeah,
or something like that. I mean, that would be the dream, of course.
Exactly. That's our goal.
Yeah.
That's where we are aiming at. But no, the answer is no. And I just have to mention this. This is very novel. All of this not just me, but us social psychologists, this is work that is maybe, you know, a decade old, you know. it's work in its infancy,
yeah,
rather than in its maturity, right? So we have more answers than more questions, sorry, than answers, but ultimately this is our goal, right? We wish to identify the most effective interventions over time as well for different contexts. And different individuals, because we also have to talk about personalization of these interventions. And we then wish to see how to scale them up to such a degree and such a level where we would then observe real world impact, right? And real world change. So that's basically the goal.
That's so fantastic. And I wonder if one could use the techniques that you develop into other areas of behavior change. And what I'm thinking, for example, of climate positive behaviors, etc. Do you think moral exemplars or other techniques that you use can be developed in other areas for good behavior change?
I haven't thought about it, but now that you bring it up, I would say, why not?
Yeah.
You know, why not if we want to, because ultimately we want behavioral change, right?
Exactly.
So the question is, what are effective interventions for changing people's behaviors? And I think that if we want, you know, behavioral change that will support climate policies, you know, et cetera, I think we can definitely borrow and learn a lot from work on intergroup conflict where these interventions have primarily focused on. So we have to also keep that in mind. So most of this work is about conflict resolution and reconciliation and peace building. But, you know, I cannot answer your question, but I can only say, yes, I could see linkages.
Yeah, because there are similarities in, exactly. in the challenges to identify with other people on other parts
yes.
of the
yes.
other groups, other parts of the world, but also to people in the future generations. And we need to close the psychological distance to these people. And what I hear in your story is that you kind of close this, you get people closer. It's an out
Correct.
Group, but you bring them closer.
Correct.
I don't know what the risk part would be in this case, but maybe you could find some other vector to get the message into.
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah. It is, in a way, decreasing social distance.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's
is,
just another way also to put it. But yes, I could I could definitely see linkage. I mean, this is really such a rich and promising research field. You know,
it is.
Maybe just me that I'm personally biased and I personally love it and admire, you know, work done in this field. But it's really, yes, promising.
I would agree. And I have not invested that much.
I hope I have sold it. Yeah. No, but it's a joke aside. Yeah.
And that's actually kind of bring us back to where we started, because we started in your personal from your personal story, and we kind of ended up in why this is so important. And it's of course maybe even more important for a person like you with your background. But I guess we can all agree that at the moment having like anything to make the world better in terms of intergroup conflicts is of course
yes.
like one of the most important things in general. So we're soon to end this interview, and before we do that, is there anything else you would like to add in this context, or anything that you really want to highlight?
Not really. Only to thank you for acknowledging the importance of this topic and the question that applies to all of us. If I have learned anything from my personal experience, is that I have grown up in a very safe and peaceful and advanced society at that time. And then overnight, things changed. And if I have learned anything, is that none of us, not one individual or not one society, can take peace for granted, or even democracies for granted. These are all very fragile realities, and we all should strive to maintain those and ensure that they don't fall apart. So it refers and applies to all of us. And I'm just happy that these topics are finding its light and space and time in Sweden as well. And thank you for inviting me, basically. I guess this is just one way or different way to say thank you for the invitation.
Very beautiful way.
Very beautiful.
You go, Sandra.
No, and just again, thank you so much for coming.
Yes,
it was really
yes,
a pleasure
my pleasure.
Having you in the podcast, and we look forward to the future and see what comes out of all this, and maybe you'll come back another time.
Yeah, let's do another episode because we only touched a little bit on this area.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah. That would be fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sabina.
My pleasure.
And Sandra.
Thanks.